Greetings and a warm welcome to the debate program with me, your host, Behrouz Najafi. Kuwait is speaking of what it calls a breakthrough toward resolving several Arab states' dispute with Qatar. Saudi airspace, land and sea borders with Qatar are supposed to be open. In 2017, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, the UAE and Bahrain cut their relations with Doha. They issued a steep list of 13 demands for their neighbor to implement or face trade and travel embargoes. Among the conditions were curbing diplomatic ties with Iran, cutting ties with Muslim Brotherhood and Hezbollah, closing the Al Jazeera TV channel, and putting an end to Turkish military presence in Qatar. No such a thing has happened, so what's responsible for this change of heart in the absence of Doha's compliance? Stay with us for a debate on that issue.
Saudi Arabia seems changing its diplomatic course with regard to neighboring Qatar as years-long blockade by Riyadh and some of its allies failed to force Doha to bow to their demands. The Kuwaiti foreign minister announced a diplomatic breakthrough, saying Saudi Arabia has decided to reopen its air, land, and sea borders to Qatar.
Based on a suggestion of Sheikh Nawaf Al Ahmed Al Sabah, Emir of the state, an agreement has been reached for the reopening of land and sea borders between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the state of Qatar starting tonight.
Following the announcement, Qatar's Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani accepted an invitation to attend a regional Arab summit in Saudi Arabia. Upon his arrival to the Saudi city of Al Ula, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman gave a warm welcome to Sheikh Tamim. In the summit, the leaders of the six-member Persian Gulf Cooperation Council signed a rapprochement agreement, although the details were not immediately released.
These efforts helped us reach the agreement of the Al-Ula statement that will be signed at this summit, where we affirm our Arab and Islamic solidarity and stability.
During the meeting, however, bin Salman missed no chance to repeat his anti-Iran rhetoric, describing Tehran's missile program as a threat to the region. But what actually had caused the conflict between Doha and Riyadh? In June 2017, Saudi Arabia, together with Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt, accused Qatar, among other things, of meddling in regional affairs and supporting terrorism. They cut ties and transport links with Qatar. Ironically, Saudi Arabia is accused of the same charges it is leveled against Qatar. Doha also repeatedly denied the allegations and said it was targeted because it followed an independent foreign policy. The boycotting countries then issued a list of 13 demands to Doha, including a downgrade in relations with Iran and the closure of the Al Jazeera television news network in return for the reconciliation. Qatar has not publicly bowed to any of the demands. Saudi Arabia has constantly pursued the policy of fueling regional tensions. Some of its allegations against Qatar even demonstrated Saudi hypocrisy, as the kingdom has long been engaged in regional conflicts. While its interference in Libya and Bahrain, as well as its anti-Iran rhetoric, is not hidden anymore, the kingdom's full-fledged war on impoverished Yemen has also exposed its hegemonic agenda. Undoubtedly, Riyadh's decision to ease the Qatar blockade proves the failure of its policy of siege and aggression. However, the credit goes to Doha, that stood firm against what it called bullying by some Arab states, and so were the Qatari citizens, who seemed galvanized by patriotic feelings.
Well, that was a report by Mehdi Rahman. Now, let me invite author and political commentator Jonathan Fryer from London. Good to have you with us, Jonathan. Beginning with the first question for you, there have been no compliance with the 13 conditions that the four Arab states tried to impose on Qatar. Doha has just accepted not to push ahead with its lawsuits in the case. But you know that the steps are being taken toward mending the ties. What's been responsible for this?
Well, a lot of the responsibility can be really accredited to Kuwait, who has played a very positive role over the last months and indeed years, determined to try to overcome, which was, after all, an absolutely absurd break in between the so-called Arab quartet of Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, UAE, and Egypt on the one hand, and Qatar on the other. It's created great difficulty for many individuals who have family on both sides of the divide. It's created all sorts of problems for people traveling, etc. But it's failed. It's been an absurd exercise, and I'm pleased that at the GCC summit today, we saw that basically the Arab Quartet has accepted that it was all a waste of time and that they have to now shake hands and make friends.
Uh, Okay, thank you for that. And let me also invite political analyst and director of the IGA, Ali Al-Ahmed, out of Washington, D.C., and ask his comments as well. Welcome to the show, Ali Al-Ahmed. My question for you, the four Arab states severed their relations with Doha over allegations of funding terrorism, and this was also echoed by President Trump. Now, Qatar never accepted the allegations and thus did nothing to appease the other side. Yet we hear Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, trying to reconcile Riyadh and Doha. What's going on?
Well, Trump found in the interest of the United States and his administration is to break up the relationship between the Saudis and the Qataris and sort of divide and conquer approach. And now that this policy continued for 3.5 years, now his policy is bring them together and get paid, because now that he's leaving the office, he's trying to have both Qatar and Saudi Arabia on his good side, because he will need funding. His son-in-law, Kushner, is also looking for billions of dollars of investment for their company. So you are looking at somebody who they're self-serving, and they're doing and they're conducting U.S. policy based on their self-interest. The U.S. has always been a party that worked on dividing Arab countries and Muslim countries, especially neighbors, because that gives them an opportunity and leverage to raise money, to sell arms, to set up bases. So they would say to Saudi Arabia, Iran is a threat. They would say to Saudi Arabia, Qatar is a threat, and Yemen is a threat. So this way we can sell you weapons, we can help you out. Mm-hmm. And that has been the policy, and that's why it's important for MBS to realize that now that he made this what I call ceasefire with Qatar, he could do that similar approach to other neighbors, to Yemen, number one, with Iran and Turkey and Syria and Iraq. Mm-hmm. It would be much more prudent for him to do that. And let's hope the Qataris can explain that to him. He would, Saudi Arabia is facing tremendous economic challenges, and if he opens up with Qatar and there is a resolution to this conflict, Saudi Arabia is set to make great economic deals with Qatar, which has a lot of cash and is able to provide Saudi Arabia with economic opportunities.
I see. Now, Jonathan, why didn't the Trump administration try and mediate between the Saudis and the Qataris sooner? I mean, why is this happening on the last days of Trump's term in office?
Well, I think the whole dispute between the Arab Quartet and Qatar just played into Trump's songbook, basically, because he sees everything in terms of a Saudi-led alliance on one side and Iran on the other. And therefore, he was throwing his eggs completely in the basket of Saudi Arabia and its allies within that very bipolar scenario. And so it really did fit his way of looking at the world. But it's interesting, I think, that all this is happening 2 weeks before the presidency of the United States will change. In just over 2 weeks' time, Joe Biden will become the new president of the United States. And although we don't know in detail what he has in mind, I think we can be sure that there will be several significant changes to Donald Trump's very aggressive policy towards Iran in particular, but disruptive policy in the Middle East in general. So I think we have to see it within that framework. And I suppose also he will claim, President Trump, that is some credit for what's just happened today at Al-Ula, that he will say, well, yes, the Americans really wanted this to happen as well, although, of course, that's not really true. It wasn't the Americans that have brought this about. It was the Kuwaitis, the Qataris, and ultimately the other members of the GCC, who realize it's in everybody's interest to work more closely together, which is, after all, what the GCC is meant to be all about.
Yeah, but the American delegation are there also to get their credit. Okay, Ali, MBS is saying that this is done, and the aim is to achieve security, in his words, and stability in this region. And some analysts argue that this is rather to form a united front against Iran. What's your reading of this?
Well, it could be. I think they are attempting to do that. They have been doing that for the past 40 years, basically. And that was the idea behind establishing the GCC, is to build a block against Iran. I think that's the wrong approach, obviously, because Iran is a neighbor. Iran cannot move, to East Asia or to Northern Europe. It is important for MBS to realize that his own interest lies in having good relationships with his neighbors, and especially Arab and Muslim neighbors. And that is where success lies. This is where economic opportunity, stability is. Stopping the war in Yemen, which has burnt over $100 billion from the Saudi coffers, is a great start for MBS. Now you can see the Arab media and social media welcoming this ceasefire, really, between Qatar and Saudi Arabia. We know that UAE and Bahrain, their rulers are not interested in having a relationship with Qatar at this moment, although they signed. So it's important to make a distinction here. This was not sort of a peace treaty, or they didn't sign a deal to restore relationship. This was basically just an announcement for ceasefire. So Qatar, yes, they opened the airspace and land the crossings, but that's it. And negotiations might succeed. It might not. It might last 1 week. It might last years. So this is not over yet. But it could provide MBS. I think he is now much more aware of the damage that he did in the past few years to his neighbors, to his country, that he may rethink that his approach. Engagement with his neighbors and ending sort of fighting and war is really in his own interest as a person, and the interest of his the people, obviously, of the region as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jonathan, some observers say that Saudis are trying to seemingly bury the hatchet with Doha. Maybe this is a sign of the Saudi failed policies in Lebanon, in Syria, and Yemen.
Well, certainly I think that what we're seeing is a shift in Saudi Arabia and in its priorities. But I'm sure this is going to take some time. I agree with your other guest, Ali, that we have to remember that UAE and Bahrain, by their recent actions, have shown, for example, that they are not at all 100% behind normalizing relations with Qatar or indeed with Iran, which is perhaps more relevant. But I think things are moving slowly in the right direction. But what will really help, of course, will be if the Saudis accept the inevitable, which is that the war in Yemen is unsustainable. It is unwinnable. This is a conflict which cannot be solved by military means. And therefore, there has to be some sort of negotiated resolution to this. And what I hope is that they can build on this first step of more GCC unity towards a positive approach towards the Yemen conflict, because that is really the crux of the situation now.
Uh-huh. And Ali, could this also be leading to a form of, jumping in the bandwagon of normalizing ties with Tel Aviv after Saudi Arabia does this with Doha?
I think if there is a peace treaty restoring of relationship between Qatar and Saudi Arabia, Israel will take a back seat. In fact, it will be hard for Israel. I think UAE is the only one who is keen on getting in bed with the Israelis, but the rest are not so much. So I think it will. I don't think people in Tel Aviv, especially Netanyahu and his ilk, are very happy that Qatar and Saudi Arabia are talking and restoring relationship. here there's an important opportunity for the leaders of the GCC to realize that you're called the GCC. You know, GCC plus these six countries has Iraq and Iran. So it's maybe an opportunity to make that council or create another council that will include these countries, because that area should have some kind of political council and meeting to talk about that country, the resources and the territory of the Persian Gulf. It's really an important.
Yeah, but Ali, you should also remember the GCC was initially formed, you know, to do something, to take moves against Iran and in defense of the then Saddam regime in Iraq.
I know that, but I'm saying that this is an opportunity to realize, maybe 40 years late, that a new vision should take hold. The Americans talk about Abraham Accord, but I talk about the Muhammad Accord, that relationship between Arabs and Muslim countries that we have paid dearly for this conflict over the past 40 plus years, because of ignoring each other and other people and our people. We have lost millions of people and trillions of dollars. I think that this is a message, I would say, that to all the leaders of the region to think it's better for them to talk, or even if they disagree, and try to solve the relationship and conflicts by words, not bombs.
Exactly. And Jonathan, that's what Iran has exactly offered since a couple of years back. You know, in 2017, the Arab Quartet tried to force Doha to sever relations with Tehran, which of course fell on deaf ears, as you know. Iran instead offered dialogue and said, if there are any source of concern, any problems, let's talk to each other. And Saudi Arabia, what it did was impose embargoes on fellow Arab Qatar. So who's playing a destabilizing role here?
Well, certainly the whole absurd being of the blockade of Qatar was a Saudi-led destabilization. But I think the things have changed. And I do share Ali's optimism in the long term that there could well be a very bright future for the Persian Gulf region if indeed there is willingness on all sides to cooperate economically and perhaps to a degree politically as well. It makes a lot of sense for there to be a wider regional cooperation. And this would actually please a lot of other countries around the world, with the Europeans and the Americans, who don't particularly wish to be further involved in the Middle Eastern region. And it would be very positive and I think get rid of a lot of negative energy if that long-term goal is kept in view. But it has to be long-term, and it needs confidence-building measures, both from Tehran and from Riyadh. Understandably, that's going to take time. There are many hurts and many wounds that people have, understandably, but they can be overcome if they realize that it's in everybody's long-term interest to actually get on a regional basis.
Okay. Now, one last question for Ali, and you had your recommendation, Ali, for Arab states and rulers there. Do you see any rapprochement on the horizon between Riyadh and Tehran?
I think it's in their interest. Look, each side can say whatever they want about each other, but at the end of the day, these are two neighbors with huge countries and resources. Both countries and the people would benefit from better relations, from cooperation instead of confrontation. You see a lot of damage because of this confrontation, and without blaming any sides here, it is important that I blame MBS obviously, but the idea is we stop blaming and let's start talking in the dialogue. This cooperation will mean jobs, will mean stability, will mean no more bombs exploding anywhere.
Okay.
No more shots being in the region. It's really important that the rulers of the region realize that the nationalists and supremacists in Washington or in London, they want this to continue so they can get their slice, they can sell their arms. But for their own interests as politicians, is to have dialogue, cooperation, and strong economic and cultural relationship. It will be better for everybody in Tehran and in Riyadh.
Okay. And Jonathan, if you have any comments in 10-20 seconds only.
Yes, I mean, I think we're entering a new era in regional relations, but it's going to take time. This is not something that's going to happen in a year or even five. It's going to take decades. But let's at least move in the right direction.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments and contribution. Author and political commentator Jonathan Fryer joined us out of London. Political analyst and director of the IGA, Ali Al-Ahmed from Washington, D.C.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, Sacrifice in Karbala. Imam Hussein alayhi salam sacrificed his life for the sake of Islam, but he did not bow to the cruel rulers, the oppressive rulers. The incident of Karbala teaches the lesson of patience, sacrifice, and sticking to righteousness. Martyrs are alive not only in history, but in reality as well. The name of the oppressor gets wiped out from the pages of history, but the martyr stays alive. The sacrifice of Mujahideen and the fighters in the battlefield, when they are walking the path of haq and truth, it is the spirit of self-sacrifice. Look at the sacred defense. When you look at what inspired and conspired against the Islamic Republic of Iran back in 1980, what did the Mujahideen do? They saw a threat. They saw the attacks of the enemy. They saw that the enemy has gathered its forces and is attacking the Islamic Republic of Iran now, the newly born Islamic Republic of Iran. What did they do? They got up from their houses, they got out of their comfort zones, and went to defend not just their country, but Islam and the Islamic government and the Islamic system as well. They knew the target of the enemy was the Islamic system of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Then you look at the example of Hezbollah. Hezbollah, the resistance force in Lebanon. Why do you think they defended themselves against the blood-sucking Zionist entity? It was because they were sold on giving sacrifices for the rest of the humanity. Look at the resistance throughout the globe. You should see the spirit of sacrifice that was shown in Karbala alive today as well. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing sacrifice in Karbala. We say that the climax of the sacrifices that have been made throughout the history was the land of Karbala, the incident of Karbala. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, along with his comrades and along with his companions and his family members, laid down his life. He gave a sacrifice. What for? For the love of humanity, for for the love of Allah, for the love of religion of Islam, for the love of righteousness. This love takes you to a level where you do not care for your own life even. Your kids, your offsprings, your friends, your comrades, your companions. The great sacrifices rendered by the martyrs of Karbala gave a new life to words like patience, tolerance, and sacrifice. The war fought between truth and falsehood in Karbala teaches Muslims to wage a war against oppression and brutality today. Sacrifices laid down by Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his companions are a beacon of light for Muslims for all times to come. The journey of martyrs of Karbala, their valor, their great sacrifices will remain alive forever. They will provide consolation and comfort to the oppressed nations and infuse new spirit. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, by the virtue of his strong character and deeds, raised the voice of truth and gave the lesson of human values. The struggle of Imam Hussein alayhi salam gives us an everlasting message to remain steadfast and affirm against cruelty, and reiterate the pledge that we have to transform our lives and this planet Earth. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
That a British court has ruled that the US prison system is too barbaric to guarantee the safety of Assange tells its own story. But this is about something much bigger than Assange. It's about journalism, the free press, and the ability to expose atrocities committed by the world's last remaining superpower. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Jake Johnson, writer. This article is published under the heading "Threat to Journalism Remains," warns critics, after Assange extradition rejected solely due to brutal U.S. prison system. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Why did a British judge reject the Trump administration's attempt to extradite Julian Assange despite accepting virtually all of the allegations the US government leveled against the WikiLeaks founder? The answer lies not in the dire threat extradition would pose to press freedoms across the globe, but in the dangerous abomination that is the US prison system. In her 132-page ruling issued on Monday, January 4th, Judge Vanessa Barrister of the Westminster Court on Monday described the conditions Assange would face in the U.S. as harsh, even compared to London's notorious maximum security Belmarsh Jail, where the publisher has been held since April of 2019. After dismissing arguments against extradition brought by Assange's legal team, including their warnings that the WikiLeaks founder would be denied a fair trial in the U.S., Barrister said she believes that if confined to a U.S. supermax prison, Ms. Assange's mental health would deteriorate, causing him to commit suicide. Faced with conditions of near total isolation without the protective factors, which limited his risk at Her Majesty Prison, Belmarsh, I am satisfied the procedures described by U.S. will not prevent Mr. Assange from finding a way to commit suicide, said Barrister, and for this reason I have decided extradition would be oppressive by reason of mental harm, and I order his discharge. As Shadow Proof Managing Editor Kevin Costola, who has been covering the extradition case from its inception, put it, the United States government mass incarceration system just lost them their case against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Lawyers for the U.S. government, which in 2019 charged Assange with 17 counts of violating the Espionage Act, said they will appeal Barrister's decision as Assange attorneys fight for his release on bail. If extradited to U.S., Assange, whose health has declined precipitously in recent months due to conditions that physicians have condemned as torture, would face up to 175 years in a maximum security prison. The aggressive effort by U.S. authorities to extradite and punish Assange for publishing classified documents that expose American war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan has been decried as a major threat to press freedoms everywhere, given that journalists regularly obtain and report on secret materials. While raising alarm over her dismissal of press freedom concerns, human rights groups, organizations welcomed Barrister's ruling against extradition as an important step in protecting Assange and other journalists around the world. Today's ruling is a huge sigh of relief for anyone who cares about press freedom, Trevor Tim, executive director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation, said in a statement. While the judge's opinion contains many worrying assertions that disregard journalists' rights, her rejection of the Trump administration's extradition request means the U.S. government likely won't be able to obtain any precedent that would criminalize common news gathering and publishing practices, and that is a very good thing. After joining others in applauding the judge's decision to reject the U.S. extradition request, Rebecca Vincent of Reporters Without Borders said she has serious concerns about the substance of the judgment. We disagree with the judge's assessment that this case is not politically motivated, that it's not about free speech, said Vincent. We continue to believe that Mr. Assange was targeted for his contributions to journalism, and until the underlying issues here are addressed, other sources, journalists, and publishers remain at risk. In a column for The Guardian on Monday, January 4th, Alan Jones wrote that it is not to critic the soundness of Barrister's legal judgment to argue that this was the right decision, but for the wrong reason. That a British court has ruled that the U.S. prison system is too barbaric to guarantee the safety of Assange tells its own story, Jones added. But this is about something much bigger than Assange. It's about journalism, the free press, and most importantly of all, the ability to expose atrocities committed by the world's last remaining superpower. John Rees of the UK Don't Extradite Assange campaign said on Monday, January 4th, that it's an incredible judgment, noting that 95% of this judge's remarks supported the prosecution. She said there is no public interest defense, there is no journalistic defense, there is no political opinion defense, said Rees. The one fact that swayed her into refusing the extradition was that the U.S. prison system is so brutal that it would increase the risk of suicide, and she wasn't willing to put him into an oppressive prison system. Noting that the U.S. will appeal, Rees argued Monday's ruling marks the beginning of the fight, not the end of the fight. But it's a terrific day, Rees added, and if the bail application, which they're discussing inside the court right at this moment, goes through and Julian walks free, that will be a terrific watershed in this case. Niels Muznik, Amnesty International Europe director, said in a statement on Monday, January 4th, that we welcome the fact that Julian Assange will not be sent to the United States and that the court acknowledged that, due to his health concerns, he would be at risk of ill treatment in the U.S. prison system. But the charges against him should never have been brought in the first place, added Muznik. The fact that the ruling is correct and saves Assange from extradition does not absolve the UK from having engaged in this politically motivated process at the behest of the United States of America and putting media freedom and freedom of expression on trial. It has set a terrible precedent for which the US is responsible and the UK government is complicit. Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ, Deputy Executive Director Robert Mahoney echoed Muznik, saying in a statement that the U.S. government's decision to charge the WikiLeaks founder set a harmful legal precedent for the prosecution of journalists around the world simply for interacting with their sources. We urge the U.S. Department of Justice to refrain from further pursuing extradition through appeals and to drop all charges against Assange.
The world with reporters.
Saudi Arabia seems changing its diplomatic course with regard to neighboring Qatar as the years-long blockade by Riyadh and some of its allies failed to force Doha to bow to their demands. The Kuwaiti foreign minister announced a diplomatic breakthrough, saying Saudi Arabia has decided to reopen its air, land, and sea borders to Qatar.
Based on a suggestion of Sheikh Nawaf Al Ahmed Al Sabah, Emir of the State, an agreement has been reached for the reopening of land and sea borders between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the State of Qatar starting tonight.
Following the announcement, Qatar's Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani accepted an invitation to attend a regional Arab summit in Saudi Arabia. Upon his arrival to the Saudi city of Al Ula, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman gave a warm welcome to Sheikh Tamim. In the summit, the leaders of the six-member Persian Gulf Cooperation Council signed a rapprochement agreement, although the details were not immediately released.
These efforts helped us reach the agreement of the Al-Ula statement that will be signed at this summit, where we affirm our Arab and Islamic solidarity and stability.
During the meeting, however, bin Salman missed no chance to repeat his anti-Iran rhetoric, describing Tehran's missile program as a threat to the region. But what actually had caused the conflict between Doha and Riyadh? In June 2017, Saudi Arabia, together with Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt, accused Qatar, among other things, of meddling in regional affairs and supporting terrorism. They cut ties and transport links with Qatar. Ironically, Saudi Arabia is accused of the same charges it has leveled against Qatar. Doha also repeatedly denied the allegations and said it was targeted because it followed an independent foreign policy. The boycotting countries then issued a list of 13 demands to Doha, including a downgrade in relations with Iran and the closure of the Al Jazeera television news network in return for the reconciliation. Qatar has not publicly bowed to any of the demands. Saudi Arabia has constantly pursued the policy of fueling regional tensions. Some of its allegations against Qatar even demonstrated Saudi hypocrisy, as the kingdom has long been engaged in regional conflicts. While its interference in Libya and Bahrain, as well as its anti-Iran rhetoric, is not hidden anymore, the kingdom's full-fledged war on impoverished Yemen has also exposed its hegemonic agenda. Undoubtedly, Riyadh's decision to ease the Qatar blockade proves the failure of its policy of siege and aggression. However, the credit goes to Doha, that stood firm against what it called bullying by some Arab states, and so were the Qatari citizens, who seemed galvanized by patriotic feelings.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's army kicked off a maneuver that put to test hundreds of its domestically built unmanned aerial vehicles. The two-day military exercises saw the use of a variety of surveillance and reconnaissance drones, combat drones, bombers, and loitering munitions, which are known as suicide drones. As part of the drill, the Persian Gulf was simulated as the conflict zone, where the Iranian Army's Navy used the suicide drones to destroy their targets.
All of the four forces of the army took part in the drills by deploying their drones. Each force concentrated on their assigned missions. We at the Navy used a variety of our stealth drones that can fly deep into the enemy's waters and keep a close eye on their activities.
The Islamic Republic of Iran's defense industry has been hit by U.S. arms embargoes for four decades. The sanctions have barred Iran from purchasing any foreign weapons, even from its closest allies. However, Iranian officials say the country's defense sector is up and running. The reason is the country has for all these years been developing its own arms, based on domestic capabilities. And now, drones are the epitome of Iran's advances in the defense industry.
In the field of UAVs, Iran is neck and neck with the few countries that have the technology. We began by producing surveillance UAVs, but today, our unmanned aircraft can conduct combat missions as well, and we owe this achievement to U.S. sanctions, because they forced us to rely on our domestic resources.
The Islamic Republic stepped into the field of UAV production around 2011 by reverse engineering American and Israeli drones it electronically commandeered or shot down. Tehran says today it is self-sufficient in designing, producing, and operating a range of UAVs with different applications. In less than a decade, the term UAV grew from an alien word to a keyword in Iran's airspace. Still, the Iranian army says this is just the tip of the iceberg, and the greater part of Iran's defense capabilities is yet to be publicized.
The Prime Minister made the announcement Monday. The country will be going back to its 2020 mantra, stay home, protect the NHS, save lives. Boris Johnson warned there were going to be tough weeks ahead, but still offered a ray of hope.
The weeks ahead will be the hardest yet. But I really do believe that we're entering the last phase of the struggle, because with every jab that goes into our arms, we are tilting the odds against COVID and in favor of the British people. And thanks to the miracle of science, not only is the end in sight, but we know exactly how we will get there.
Some children across England had one day in school before the announcement was made, and people are vexed by yet another last-minute announcement. The opposition says the government is going to make mistakes, but to make the same mistakes again is unacceptable. But Boris Johnson insists the tier system was working and that the new variant of COVID-19 is what derailed it. The Prime Minister's remarks caused hashtags resign, school closures, and Boris has failed the UK to shoot to the top of the country's Twitter trending charts. He is accused of ignoring the science by insisting schools are safe. The third lockdown will be hard for families juggling work and school, but many companies in the leisure, retail and hospitality sectors feel they might not make it through to the spring. In response to these fears, the Chancellor of the Exchequer made an announcement Tuesday.
Well, in order to help support businesses through a difficult period through to the spring, today we've announced £4.6 billion of additional help. For businesses in the most affected sectors who are asked to close, they will receive up to £9,000 in a one-off cash grant. It's important to remember that comes on top of the existing monthly grant of £3,000 that those businesses receive and the extension of furlough all the way through to April. You know, we remain committed to protecting jobs and supporting businesses.
The new COVID-19 restrictions come days after the UK and the EU reached a trade and security agreement as part of their Brexit divorce deal, and businesses in Britain had to start trading differently. They were dreading this, but now they say planning around COVID-19 restrictions has made the extra paperwork surrounding post-Brexit trade pale into insignificance. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Christmas holidays are almost over in Italy. It's been a particularly testing time for many as the country is struggling to recover from the economic slowdown caused by the coronavirus pandemic. A study by the National Farmers Association called Diretti has found that about 4 million Italians have been seeking help, many for the first time, to put food on the table during these Christmas festivities. The association has warned the number of people needing food support has doubled compared to last year.
These figures give a snapshot of what the current economic situation is in Italy. 4 million people had to resort to soup kitchens or food pantries this Christmas due to the anti-COVID restrictions. The situation is rapidly aggravating, with our estimates indicating that this year many more will join the ranks of the poor.
About one-third of all people seeking help in Italy during the pandemic are first-time recipients. Charitable groups have warned, in a reversal of usual trends, most are Italians and not foreign residents.
According to Coldiretti, among the new poor in Italy, there are those who have lost their jobs, small traders or artisans who were forced to shut down, people employed in the underground economy who do not enjoy special subsidies or public aid, and have no savings or assets to fall back on.
The economic crisis caused by the pandemic is wreaking havoc, especially among the middle classes. We weren't expecting this to happen so quickly.
Some have lost their job. Some others work much less compared to pre-COVID times. Some friends of mine couldn't buy presents. Some had to give up many other things. It's really hard for an increasing number of people.
The government is reportedly looking at extending the current restrictions until January 15, meaning that non-essential shops will be closed and bars and restaurants can only do takeaway services during weekends. A major question is whether Italy's high schools will reopen as planned on January 7. Max Civili, Rome.
After months of deliberation, witness statements, and arguments made for and against his extradition, the day of reckoning finally arrived, when the world would know the fate of Julian Assange, the co-founder of WikiLeaks. Would he or would he not be extradited to the United States, where he could face up to 175 years in a US supermax prison under special administrative measures? That was the question on everyone's mind. So naturally, there was a big sigh of relief from Assange's supporters when British judge Vanessa Barrister ruled against his extradition, a decision the US prosecutors will certainly appeal.
Since languishing in one of the UK's most notorious prisons after being forcibly removed from the Ecuadorian embassy, supporters of Julian Assange hoped and prayed that the courts would side with their position. But nonetheless, the verdict still came as a huge surprise.
I expected the worst. It's been awful throughout. It's been the way, you know, just everything about the case has been completely illegitimate, basically. And the fact that we won, Julian is free, is just beyond belief.
Yet for those closest to Julian, there was still room for concern.
Today is a victory for Julian. Today's victory is the first step towards justice in this case. We are pleased that the court has recognized the seriousness and inhumanity of what he has endured and what he faces. But let's not forget, the indictment in the US has not been dropped. We are extremely concerned that the US government has decided to appeal this decision.
According to Rebecca Vincent from Reporters Without Borders, the judge's comments still left space for journalists reporting on British and American war crimes to be prosecuted going forward.
Situation for journalism and for press freedom in both the UK, the US, and internationally. Because what we heard today, the substance of the ruling, or the substance of the judge's decision before she addressed the health issues, was very much that she agreed with the case that the prosecution had made. She threw out many of the defense's arguments that the free speech arguments and the sort of the arguments that this was indeed a political case. So we disagree with those areas of the decision.
Assange's case has been followed by people from around the world because of its significance and far-reaching implications. And although many are happy with the judge's ruling and ecstatic that Julian Assange will be finally reunited with his family, there was still a feeling that although an important battle had been won, the fight to protect press freedoms and the right to expose US war crimes and crimes against humanity was far from over. Ahmed Kabella, London.
The Islamic movement in Nigeria held a ceremony attended by many of its members to commemorate General Qasem Soleimani. The theme of the event echoed the organization's earlier statement that the world cannot forget the martyrdom of the Iranian general. The Islamic movement described the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani as a war crime, adding that those who carried out the murder must be held to account.
Is very important as an international figure who was able to stop the capture of Syria from the forces of ISIS and Daesh. He was also able to empower the Islamic resistance, the Palestinian Islamic resistance against the Israel. And he's also able to stop the advancement of ISIS in Iraq.
Various speakers at the lecture described late General Soleimani as a strong defender of the Palestinian resistance who took a stand against the Zionist occupation forces. They said General Soleimani played an important role in the liberation of the Syrian city of Aleppo and eliminating Daesh terrorists. The speakers described General Soleimani as a champion of interreligious harmony who will be missed.
We feel that we are together with the principles on which General Qasem Soleimani died. And that is the principle of justice, the principle of preventing, trying to establish justice on the face of the earth, and also the principle of trying to prevent oppression and tyranny.
The lecturer said the martyrdom of General Soleimani and his ally, Deputy Head of Iraqi Popular Mobilization Units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, has added a glorious chapter in the history of self-sacrifice. The Islamic movement in Nigeria said General Qasem Soleimani was a man of God and a hero of Islam who succeeded in confronting and defeating enemies of Islam. They said Qasem Soleimani contributed in saving millions of innocent lives and protecting the holy shrines, thereby bringing honor, dignity, and pride to the Muslim Ummah. Benjamin Abdullahi, Kano.
A ceremony attended by Syrians, Palestinians, Iranians, and Yemenis was held in Damascus to mark the first martyrdom anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's ambassador to Syria asserted that the resistance front will continue to fight back against any aggression, reiterating the assassination was a sign of the weakness of the United States.
By firing the missile on General Soleimani, the U.S. targeted the Iranian people, their power, and pride. The U.S. wanted to thwart the resistance front's plans, but they failed. They have no choice but to leave the region.
Delegates from Syria's Ba'ath Arab Socialist Party and Yemen also delivered words on General Soleimani and his achievements in leading resistance fighters against the Western plots in the region. Vice Secretary General of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine said General Soleimani told him the only path to liberate Palestine was armed struggle and national unity between Palestinians.
General Soleimani urged us to depend on ourselves instead of others. Thanks to his efforts and advices, today we make weapons and the Palestinian resistance is currently in constant development.
Photos of General Soleimani were also exhibited, showing moments of his missions across Syria and Iraq. For years, General Soleimani led Iranian military advisors in Syria at Syria's request and played a key role in defeating Daesh terrorists as well as restoring security to hundreds of square kilometers across the Arab country. For over a week, Syrians, Iranians, and Palestinians have commemorated General Soleimani's martyrdom. And as observers say, contrary to the U.S. and its regional allies' will, General Soleimani's assassination has further strengthened unity among all members of the resistance front. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
A compact group of demonstrators took the street again in Paris to protest against police violence, and in particular against the impunity of police officers who used the very controversial method of knee-to-neck choke with fatal consequences. 1 year ago, Cédric Chouviat died after 22 seconds of knee-to-neck choke that caused him fatal wounds. He died in a hospital 2 days later. 4 police officers were directly involved and indicted for involuntary homicide. The family of the victim asked for their suspension.
We have asked the Interior Minister to suspend the 4 police officers involved in the death and the murder of my father. We have been waiting for their suspension for 1 year now. There is no progress at all. We are waiting for a reaction, a real one.
Assa Traoré is the sister of Adama Traoré, murdered also by the knee-on-neck choke, the same method that killed George Floyd. That led to a worldwide protest asking the ban on such dangerous techniques.
That technique of immobilization used by police forces must be forbidden. That technique is fatal. We have denounced that method for 4 years now because Adam Traoré died exactly the same way as Cédric Chouviat, with a knee on his neck. Both said their last words, "I can't breathe." If French authorities had listened to us, Cédric Chouviat would not have died.
This protest is not only against police violence, but also against the global security law that would facilitate police violence, or at least would make it more difficult to film police violence. It's thanks to video footage that the beating of a music producer in Paris by police officers last November was made public.
Abnormal things are happening in this country from the police side. The government is obliged to react because there is an important mobilization, especially from the youth, against the global security law. It's important to withdraw that law.
The march ended under the Eiffel Tower, the place where Cédric Chouviat was choked to death. Cédric Chouviat died with a knee-on-neck choke. As long as this method will not be forbidden by the French government, the impunity of police officers will continue. Chris Denhant, Paris.
On the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iranian commander General Qasem Soleimani and his companions, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip came together to thank the general for his support in their struggle against the Israeli aggression.
The assassination of General Soleimani has not stopped Iran's support for the Palestinian cause. Our resistance will